The Umbrella Hour is brought to you by the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Your hosts today are Dr. Ahn, board-certified clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. Xander will do the honors and introduce our guest.
Yes, thank you so much, Ahn. I'm really looking forward to this interview today. I mean, you know, I look forward to all of our interviews. We talk to wonderful, wonderful people. But our guest today is Fika El-Nagashi. Fika is a former member of the Austrian Parliament with the Greens, or what we might say here in the United States, the Green Party. Maybe it's a little bit different there. She's also a lifelong human rights advocate and the founder and director of the Athena Forum. It is truly an honor to have you on the show today, Fika. Welcome.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Absolutely. I was thinking we could start with you just telling us what was the inspiration behind running for parliament, and then we can follow that up with talking about your human rights work. And most specifically, we definitely want to hear all about what the Athena Forum is for, what it's doing, and what your hopes and goals are for that.
Yes. So to be honest, I never really wanted to be a politician. It was not on my list. I did not aspire to go into politics. So I started political work when I was quite young. I started political activism, and I was 19 when I started to engage with youth organizations that were organized on a European level. So that gave me the opportunity to meet other young people from somehow similar backgrounds, but also very different to me. So my identity and my background became very central to me and to my reflections when I was young. I was born in Hungary. My mother is Hungarian. My father is Egyptian. I grew up in Austria. And then I came out as a lesbian quite young. So to reflect upon what does this all mean and in the context that I'm put into, that was something that really drew my attention and my energy. And then that became a political engagement and political activism and political work. So I did that for a long time throughout my youth, throughout my 20s. And then I started to work in the civil society sector. So I worked with the Migrant Women's Organization, and I worked around issues of migrant women in the sex industry. And then I moved on to some other organizations, still NGOs that I was working with. And I did that for 15 years. And then I found myself between jobs, but I was also a little bit frustrated with the NGO sector. I felt that there were limitations that I had reached of what could be done. I found that many of them were in a dependence to the funders. So not only in terms of resources, but also politically, very limited in what they could actually do and how they could be impactful and actually change something. And then there was a job opening with the Greens. And that was the first time that I engaged with the party, with the political party. I was never affiliated with the party before, and I had my reservations. But I thought I could just give it a try and see if I like it or not, and I could leave anytime, or so I thought. And so I did this job. It was a part-time position, a maternity leave replacement, so quite limited, for a year. And while I was working there, I saw what the politicians around me were doing. And I actually thought to myself, I think I can do that too. And that's when I decided to run. And somehow I succeeded for a number of reasons. I think I fit their poster girl design quite well with my biography, with what I have been doing before. Greens have a strong affiliation with the civil society, with NGOs. So I think they liked what they saw, quite literally. And they didn't know me so well, so we didn't have a lot of time to have conflicts or to really understand where we would agree or disagree. It was a lot of projection also, I think. And so I got elected in 2015 onto state level parliament, so in provincial parliament in Vienna. And then in 2019, we had early elections on the national level. And by then I had been very active still with civil society organizations in opposition to the former government. And it was like a logical next step to then run on the national level. And I felt that I was carried into that position really by a lot of the communities that I have been engaged with. And they were quite broad. It was on migrant issues, refugees, the LGBTIQ sector. By then, it has become quite broad, but it's been a group that I've been engaged with from the beginning. And so that in 2019, I got elected into parliament. So last year, my mandate ended. And with that, 10 years in politics, 10 years as a politician, and 10 years with the Greens. And this year, I left my party. So
Oh.
this year, before summer, I very publicly left my party. There has been a lot of conflict in the last years because of my public position on gender identity and me speaking critically about gender identity from a feminist perspective and as a lesbian. And that did not go down well at all. And this escalated. So there were open letters against me and all kinds of attacks internally, also within the party. And finally, there was a motion to expel me brought forward by a trans-identified man within my party that was eventually not successful. But the whole procedure was it was a harrowing situation to be put through. And then I decided that I will leave the party, and I will talk very publicly about what has been going on. Not only the difficulty of talking about these subjects, but also what happens to a party member, a former politician, the accusations, the defamations, the reputational damage if you decide to leave the party line on this and say quite moderate things, I think, as I've been doing.
I have a question for you. That obviously must have been very difficult given your position. Why? I think I understand. I think Xander does as well. Why were you viewed as anti-trans for defending the need to uphold feminism and that identity? Why would you be considered anti-trans?
There is no other framing for that. So it's either you agree with whatever is being put forward from the activist side or the trans activist side. And many of these things have become more and more extreme and unquestionable and undebatable. So either you fully align with that and agree or remain silent. If you disagree, you should remain silent. But if you publicly oppose it, then there is no other framing than to say that you're transphobic, and that's not the end of it. That's just the beginning. So the accusations, and I have experienced this myself, but it is also so widely happening that you're accused of being transphobic, of being racist, of being, well, outright evil, but also of being right-wing, of being fascist, of being anti-democratic, of being anti-human rights. And I've had all of these accusations. Even though it's difficult, you know, to see how it would make sense in any way, but the accusations are there, they're happening, and they have an effect, and they intend to have an effect. So one of the effects is isolation, for example. So other people, organizations would not want to basically be associated with you anymore. It would be very difficult for you to collaborate with anyone, be it professionally or personally. And it has very wide-ranging effects, this isolation. But it also sends a signal, of course, to everybody else. So if this is something that can be done to me, imagine what can be done to you.
Yeah, well, Manon said that he understands and he thinks that I understand as well. It has a lot to do with I went through something much smaller scale, right? Because I wasn't in politics, but I was involved with a global nonprofit that focuses on transgender health care called WPATH,
Oh,
World
yeah.
Professional Association for Transgender Health. And I ran afoul of the orthodoxy also. And what's really interesting to me is how this is become almost like a religion that these are the prescribed views and you must recite them. And if you don't, then you are a heretic, you're a blasphemer, and you should be removed from community. You should be excommunicated. You should be banned, and everybody is to turn their back on you. And then all of those words come in your direction, right? I've heard all the same. I've been called all those same things. And of course, it makes no sense. That's not the goal, right? The goal isn't for it to make sense, right? Their goal is to put a label on you, and then people see it on social media and go, oh, it must be true because it's being said publicly and everybody must agree. So the reader or the listener, if it's something maybe on a podcast, I think they're thinking, well, I don't want to run afoul. I don't want to go against the expected orthodoxy. So yeah, maybe I will not say anything, or maybe I'm just going to join in and join the mob, right? And pile on in the attack of the person. And what's really interesting in both of our circumstances, again, at different scales, but similar, is that you have a track record of working for NGOs, human rights, for being part of a community. You have demonstrated your commitment to these issues and these people and these lives. It's the same for me. Everybody can go back in my history and see that. And so the isolation, yes, but also, and I'm wondering if you had this experience. For me, it was very destabilizing. It's like the rug's pulled out from underneath you. The what you're standing on is gone. And interestingly enough, when I got up and looked around, the people who were the most supportive, this is not entirely, but a lot of the people who were the most supportive and were welcoming to me and wanted me to belong with them were the conservatives. You might have different language, right? And so all of a sudden, it's like, wait a minute, aren't those people supposed to be the ones who don't like me and approve and agree, but they're being really nice to me. It didn't seem in any sort of nefarious way. And this is my community and they're rejecting me. It was very bizarre. It took me a couple of years to really get my footing. But then as time has gone on, some of those people that are in that middle place, they're part of LGBT community, but they're also more conservative socially, at least on this one issue, have now also pulled away from even trans people like myself to distance. Right? Because now it's a slippery slope, I guess. Does that make sense to you? Is that something that's happening also, even with the Athena Forum? Are you trying to find a way to do more of the LGB thing? And the T's got to figure it out on their own. And I hope to God we do, but yeah.
I mean, there's a lot in there. So, I mean, I agree 100% with these two descriptions. One is the rug being pulled out from underneath you. It was absolutely destabilizing completely. I mean, I had a little bit now, in retrospect, I would say I had some arrogance about me because I somehow thought that I was uncancelable because of my track record, because of where I came from, because of who I was. It's like, surely they would. Would not do this with me. Surely this would not work with me. How would they try and put these labels on me? But they did. And I was wrong with my assessment. And they did not only a little, but they completely did it. So this rock that gets pulled out underneath you, I mean, you can use different words for it, but even if you say destabilize, it takes you apart. You come apart completely and then you put yourself back together again. And you can only hope and pray that you put yourself back together with integrity. So, not only in all of your parts, and you don't have a part of it missing, but you do it in the right way. So, it really is a life-changing experience, if you can call it that, or car crash. It's really very difficult and extremely disorienting. Not only disorienting on the personal level, as in when you look around, who's there and who's not and who's gone and who's missing. So recently I've been thinking it's a bit like mass breakup. Everybody's breaking up with you at the same time. That's a lot. For me, in my situation, it might have been similar for you also, Xander, because my social life and my political and professional life were fully merged. So it was not like my job is here and my private life is there, and then I socialize somewhere in between. It was all the same. So it affects you completely. 360 degrees. But the other destabilization level is for the political footing. So where do I actually stand with my beliefs, with my political convictions, and to question more of what is presented as either a political position or maybe more specifically even a policy, and to question it as an ideology. So I found myself questioning many of my beliefs. So what do I still believe? And in what way? And what do I now see differently? And what do I allow myself to potentially maybe see differently? Not now, because it's just too much to question everything at all, but in future. And I will put on hold, but I know, oh, this is something I have to revisit. I should go there at one point. And there have been many such things. So it's like a complete turnaround. And I had a similar experience like you did. So in that very, very intense first period that went on for a few weeks, where every week or every day I discovered something new. There was a new comment on social media, there was a new message, there was an email, there was somebody telling me that they can no longer be in my company. And there was nothing from my colleagues, from my own party. They just pretended nothing was happening. And there was one individual who called me once a week just to ask me how I was doing. Nothing else, just how are you? And she is a colleague from the Christian Conservative Party. And that, I really do remember that, you know, her reaching out in that way.
Just very briefly, I had a very similar experience, not at your level, obviously, but I had been very involved with the LGBT community. And the attempt there, while I can relate to both of your circumstances, because I did experience that, but the other piece to that was being invited to talk about what happened, why I did what I did, or why I said what I said. And then the attempt to get to know members of my family, for instance, and then shame me or attempt to shame me. I wasn't easily shamed because I just wasn't going to let them puncture my skin that way. And I was fully prepared for that. But it didn't just happen once, it happened several times. And in one case, by an organization who I supported, I had done, I felt, everything ethically right. And it was that isolation, but it felt to me like being thrown into a spin cycle. And it took me months to sort through all of it. And I ended up leaving that community for that reason. I'm in touch with some of them, but it really taught me a lesson on how to listen differently and what to look for.
Were they trying to get at you through your family?
We had a conversation about some of my relatives because I didn't grow up here. I grew up in Europe, but some of my relatives were all over. And one of them was a historian and he wrote books. And the comment that followed my remark to the question I was given about what my relatives did was something along these lines. Oh, so you think of yourself as a journalist, do you? Because I had written on WordPress. It was my own shtick, really. It was all my own stuff. And it was cleansing for me. I since then have shut it down, not for fear, but I didn't have a need for it anymore. And it was just really interesting how that flew back at me. And so many times, a couple of people said to me, well, why didn't you just come back with this, that? And I said, I don't feel it's an effective way to communicate. When I'm with people and I want them to understand what transpired, it's a learning curve for them and me. So for me to come back with a smart aleck remark or sarcasm does nothing. All that does is digs the wound deeper. So I didn't do that. But like I said, it took me months to sort through. And I don't think they were after my family per se. It was just a dig. It was more of a dig.
It sounds like an attempt at maybe dehumanization or demonization. They're just going to go right for the jugular. There's I mean, it's a dirty game that gets played. So, Fika, when we were communicating before we sat down to record this session, and we asked you, what is it you would like to talk about? And I'm going to nutshell it, right? I'm just going to, you said something about what's happening in Brussels. And so I would imagine that this is also where you can talk about the Athena Forum, right? And what did you found it? And what is it doing? And what is the goal? What are you really wanting to be able to do with the forum?
So maybe to connect it to what you have previously asked.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kag. And our guest this hour is Fika El-Nagashi, a former member of parliament in Austria with the Greens, a lifelong human rights advocate and founder and director of Athena Forum. We'll be taking a short commercial break. Don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kag. And our guest this hour is Fika El-Nagashi, who is a former member of parliament in Austria with the Greens, a lifelong human rights advocate, founder, and director of Athena Forum. Let's get back to the show.
So maybe to connect it to what you have previously asked, I've set up a new organization and we're moving into this field where many of us have experienced something similar to what we've just talked about, or at least are aware of this, you know, potentially happening to them. And then there are a number of other challenges also, how to get along with each other, basically, how to get along with each other when we have strong convictions on one hand, but on the other hand, we'll definitely not always agree with each other about everything. And how can we learn from the experiences that we've had, but also from what we see happening around all the time? And how can we mitigate that risk? So maybe we're a little bit in that relation in a somewhat privileged situation because we have made that experience. Of course, that does not free us from repeating it. or parts of it, but at least we're trying to be aware of it. So one of the things that I'm bringing into setting up this organization is to make it clear, I don't want us to police each other around certain issues or the depth of our beliefs in a similar way, mirroring what is happening in other groups, communities, contexts, wider movements, you know. It's so easy for something these days to think of themselves as a movement or as a community. When I don't know what the two of you would say, but I'm very careful now to consider anything a community. After an experience like this, it's a rhetoric. It's a rhetoric that's meant to draw you in and then to oblige you. So we're setting up an organization and we are trying to be aware, especially also of the challenge of being a European organization. So we will also have different national contexts, cultural contexts, political contexts, different languages also, different needs and speeds. So it is quite a big thing to do. But the intention why I did it, I think, came from two directions. One was that I felt that this is what I could productively do. So I'm equipped with what it takes to do this kind of work from my experience, my background. When I worked in the civil society sector, I was working with a number, or I was engaged, active with a number of these organizations that I'm now facing and criticizing. So I have an inside perspective into the civil society aspect of it, but I also have an understanding of the policy level, having worked as a politician for 10 years and having seen the impact of European politics on the national level. And I think what I've seen is like an example. It's not very different from how it's happening and manifesting in other countries. And also my political environment, I think, is quite representative in general of how politicians work and function. And to summarize it, it's with a great level of ignorance, negligence, and laziness. So that's not a very positive comment to make, but it is part of the reason why we're in the situation that we're in on many levels, but specifically now with this topic. So I think I'm the exact right person to do this. And I've always felt that with the jobs that I've had, if I consider them as jobs, that if I felt that another person could be doing what I'm doing, then it's not me who has to do it. And now with what I'm doing now, I feel that it is me who has to do it. So that was one of the reasons. And the other one was that I saw that there was a gap, a vacuum in terms of having an organization that can actually look at what is happening in the European institutions. That is a very complex machinery, very abstract, very distant for many people, for most people, for almost everybody who does not live in that bubble, and see what the impacts of that are and try to translate this in a way that other people, well, millions of people across Europe can follow what is happening, can understand it so that it makes sense to them and can engage in debates about these issues and to open up the space for these debates in a way that they don't feel that if they open their mouth and say anything about it, they are branded a right-wing fascist. And to basically take it apart and look at all of the different aspects of these, say, policy measures that are being developed and pushed and promoted. And almost all of it is happening in a way that it is taking place behind closed doors. So there's absolutely no general awareness of it. And the things that are happening are very far-reaching and very impactful. So it's not only about what it is that's happening and decided, but it's also about the lack of democracy and democratic process around it. And it is undermining the credibility of these institutions that I actually still care about. So I don't want to dismantle the EU as such. I think it's a shame that they are doing this to themselves.
When you mentioned just a moment ago about why things might have ended up how they've ended up, and I remember laziness, but you know, my ADHD brain, I forget what you said before the two. Maybe ignorance or...
Yes, ignorance and negligence. Yeah.
Negligence. And another word that came to my mind was cowardice. And then I chastised myself a little bit and went, "Well, Xander, that's not very nice." Maybe it's also, I'm not saying that's not true for some people. One of the things that I've been thinking about for the last couple of years is we went so long in our history just as a people, right? And the different ways in which who had rights, who didn't have rights, and how over a period of time that has changed and changed. And this idea that we would come into the 21st century and people would be like, "Wait, what are you talking about? What do you mean trans people don't have rights? So we need to do this right now and do it with this push of how could we get to this place? Why didn't trans people get rights when gay people got rights? And why didn't gay people get rights when women got rights? And why didn't women get rights when people of color around the world, also different peoples, right? Different ethnic and racial group. Why is it happening? This drip, 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 drip." And so I think it was actually quite strategic for the movement, so to speak, the LGBT and tack on all the other letters, to push it from that perspective, to be like, what are we waiting for? Why hasn't this already happened? And I think what that did, at least in the way I'm theorizing it, is that a whole bunch of people all over the Western world went, okay, yeah, of course. Gosh, we were so late in getting marriage rights and voting rights. And of course, we're not going to stand in your way. I think it was a well-intentioned acceptance of this is the next thing in the evolution of rights. And by that, I mean specifically trans people, right? Getting healthcare, changing identity documents. And then it just kept going and going and going. And I think even when people started to notice, like, oh, excuse me, wait a minute, maybe we should have some boundaries on things like who competes in which sport category, or maybe we should have some boundaries on who undresses in certain settings. Maybe by then it was like, oh, well, now how do we roll back? It's like the floodgate just opened up wide, because I don't think anybody, for the most part, suspected that we would ever be where we are right now. I know I didn't really think that way. I was 39 when I started my transition. I'm an old school dyke, and I was like, trans women, sure, they can exist, but they're not part of our lesbian community. Like, they're separate. And the few trans women that did intermingle with lesbian community, it was very clear, okay, they're still married to the same woman they've been married to for a decade or two or three, and they want to be lesbians now, you know, or something. And we were sort of like, all right, I don't know why you'd want to hang out with us. We have no rights at all. You know, so it wasn't the same as what's going on now.
Yeah.
It's very different. This is a big wheel that I don't know how it gets returned or turned around, right? Are you starting to operationalize or at least formalize some of what actually could happen so that we don't erase sex-based rights for women in particular? But I think there's for men, that's also an issue in some things, but also not erode all of the rights that trans people have gained. I wonder if there's a way to keep what we've gained, but not in any way that infringes on other groups' rights. Because I think that's what's happened, is the infringement has now happened. I don't think that was predicted.
I think there are many things that have happened. And the way that you describe the setting, the scene back then, that's exactly how I've experienced it when I was young, exactly in that same way. So not only basically including more and more groups into a framework of anti-discrimination or equal rights, is what has happened. I think that's only one aspect or one minor part maybe of it. Now, I am very focused on the political level, on politics, on the responsibility of the political class. And I'm very upset with them because where, in what other part would you have a lobby group or demands and then you have the rest who just follows? And you had conservatives who were following and going along with the demands. You had progressives, liberals, greens, social democrats. So when I say laziness, I really mean it. I'm not just saying there's a politician who's not working for his or her money. It's truly political laziness to the extent that there is no ideological foundation in a neutral sense of belief system, a set of beliefs that guide their political position. And from that, they can then agree or disagree to certain demands, but also can draw a line. And this drawing of a line just never happened. So now I could be upset with the activists, you know, and I can say, why did you bring forward positions or demands that were more and more unhinged? But my anger is directed to those who accepted these demands and turned them into their party programs or into law and legislation, because there is no excuse for that. And one of the things that I'm upset about is, for example, now on the European level, I was not talking specifically about what it is that is happening behind closed doors in the European Union institutions. So one of the things that they are pushing for is to promote self-ID laws across Europe without age limits. And that is one of the things that I'm upset about. So why is nobody drawing a boundary? I think it would even be much more difficult to attack them or to criticize them if they would draw an age limit, be it 18, 16, 14. But they cannot even bring themselves to do that. They cannot even say 14, because the trans activist demands are without age limit. And they have completely subordinated themselves to the demands. They cannot say no to this lobby group. And so I wonder, you know, what is happening in that dynamic that you cannot say no to demands that just don't even fit with your political position. The president of the European Commission is a conservative, at least in theory. She is aligned with the Conservative Party. So where do you fit this in your ideological worldview, in your credibility as a political party, as a political force, as a political position that wants to impact or change this world within a specific view, if you're doing exactly what the activists want of you? And another point that they have that they are promoting is conversion therapy bans, for example. So it's the explorative talking therapies with children and adolescents who are in distress about their sex and or sexual orientation. And this has been framed as conversion therapy. So here to say we're putting bans on this and on therapists who would work in that explorative way. So all of these are things that would not, I think, align with the positions of the political parties if they would confront themselves with what it actually means.
I wanted to add that I think we've moved away from looking at what we now know about the human brain and maturity. We hear about it, but I don't think we're paying much attention to it, in that there are some cases, of course. I've met some of these individuals who at a very young age are quite mature and are very cognitively aware of who they are. Not just in the context of trans identity or a lesbian identity or a gay identity, but majority of youth, we know that there are complications in their life. We know in some of these cases there has been trauma. All of that delays maturing. And we know that that brain isn't fully developed at 18, let alone at 16, and in some cases, even 28.
It just hinges on what amount of trauma they've had and the number of incidences they've been up against. But I think also we've seemed to have lost some sense of what it means to practice ethically when we take on roles. And if we're not, as you said, if we're not really living up to those expectations, what are the incentives? Is it collecting? I know in the US you collect a paycheck, but we have 5 minutes remaining. Outside of that, what are some of the incentives that drives people to do the unthinkable, which is not paying attention to the long-term harms that we will be delivering?
Yeah, the incentives that are driving them, or what is keeping them from doing it. And I think there is one incentive, and that's there are some other things also. So often they just don't care. They just don't care. It is a niche. It is still a niche subject to them. It's complicated. It's messy. And they don't care. So somebody will tell them and the others will just go along with it. But then there are those who truly believe, and they are also well applauded for it by the groups that are pushing for it, that this is the right thing to do. And they get moral vindication for doing this and being an ally. And it's very much on such a superficial level that it's basically just slogans.
We are taking our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Fika El-Nagashi, a former member of parliament in Austria with the Greens, a lifelong human rights advocate, founder, and director of Athena Forum. We'll be back shortly. Don't go away.
UK House Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job. She was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy. But every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg, and our guest this hour is Fika El-Nagashi, a former member of parliament in Austria with the Greens, a lifelong human rights advocate and founder and director of Athena Forum. Let's get back to the show.
There is no substance in it. So being an ally is completely void of substance. They give out badges. They give out badges. They promote you. They put you on their social media. They celebrate you. So it's a feel-good thing. And some actually really believe that the other side, they are evil and they are now on the good side and it is some kind of apocalyptic showdown. And I think then there are those who are kept from saying something because they are aware that they would put themselves out there and risk a lot. And that is framed by a mass deception in a way, where you have so many different sectors of society that go along with the same storytelling. So it is the way that mainstream media are reporting about this. It is what academia is producing. It is what's happening in the civil society sector. And it's not only the queer part. It is the anti-racism part, just the same as the feminism part, well, the queer feminism part, just the same as the climate activism part. So the whole civil society sector, the human rights sector in the widest sense, you have organizations like Amnesty International, big human rights players that are in this. And it's a very compelling situation and context in which you are placed, and then as an individual would have to show up for something that you believe in.
You made the reference a little earlier in our conversation, Fika, about the experience you went through was like a mass breaking up with, right? And it made me think about something you just said about what people get when they go along, right? The badges and the inclusion and the promotion. What's really interesting is how similar, and we just think about relationships. It's a very difficult thing to go through a breakup. On the other end of it, I haven't had this experience, but the love bombing, right? That happens for some people in early part of a relationship, oftentimes with somebody who's really toxic and wants to just get you in by love bombing you. And so it sounds like what's happening is these people are championing a cause without really knowing much about it. They just are believing that it's a righteous cause. And because those people over there know better than I do. And so I'm going to listen to them, and then they're going to take me in, and I'm going to get love bombed, and I'm going to be part of like a family, right? We were just talking a little bit ago about family and how when you go against the orthodoxy, you become estranged from your family, this community of family. And I also don't think of anything as a community or movement anymore either. If you do what we want you to do, you're going to get love bombed. If you don't do what we want you to do, you're going to get excommunicated. You're going to be estranged from us. And as human beings, we are hardwired to be part of something, right? So we're still oriented that way. And so I think that's what drives a lot of this, is that desire to not be kicked out of the house. Is Athena Forum doing lobbying work, or are you creating materials, whether they're printed or audio or video, that highlights some of the issues that if people just thought things through, they might go, oh, wait a minute. Because I think, at least in the United States, that was a very successful strategy when the gay rights movement separated away from the queer rights movement. And they went and talked with and built bridges with and had alliances with people that were supposedly anti-gay and didn't want gay people to get married. And they ended up becoming not huge champions, I don't know, but they at least stopped blocking the way for same-sex marriage to go through the process of becoming legal. And I think it's because everyday gay people, not the queer people, not the people who want to tear everything down, but the people who are like, no, we just want to work and we want to have a family and we want to do all the things that everybody wants to do, that they went to those people and said, I think you're mistaken on who we are and what we want. And they went, oh, okay, well, let's talk it through. And eventually then they got out of the way. So I'm wondering if there's a way for you to target people like this leader, this conservative leader, in a way that's not like you should automatically hate these people, not that kind of thing. Have you really thought through what it could mean if at any age people can self-identify into a sex category and what that might mean with your work, thinking it all the way through, how it might actually work or not work, as the case might be, and how much danger we might be putting people into. Because if you can self-ID at any age, well, what's to stop them from saying you can do this at any age or this at any age or that at any age? Where do they stop? But to me, that's the queer agenda, is to remove age limits from everything. And they've been at it for a long time now, since the 60s, that getting rid of age limits. And so it's not a good thing. But how do we tell people that in a way that they'll understand, that relates to their own point of view, that doesn't sound like you're coming across as a bigot? It's a fine line to walk, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I would hope that I don't come across as a bigot. That's very difficult because, I mean, there's such a barrier to break through. You know, so what we can do is we can offer our perspective and our reasoning and ourselves even, because that's what we're doing. When I'm speaking and I've set up Athena Forum, I'm the face of it, I'm the director, I'm offering myself in a way because people want to see who is speaking about this, who is this person, who is this position. So we're offering up ourselves and try to get people to listen. And if it is the conservatives who listen, that's great. And if it is some progressives that listen, that's fantastic. We just want to generate this a broader debate with the different perspectives, to have parents come in the discussion, to have the transitioners come in the discussion, to have trans-identified people come in the discussion, to have lesbians and gays, feminists, and to make this a broad discussion and not something that's about either or, left or right, fascist or ally, saint, whatever.
I just want to thank you again for coming on the show. And why don't you tell the listener where they can follow what you're doing? We're going to post this up on different social media, but if you want to also include just a brief, where can they find out more about the work you're doing online?
So I'm on X. I have an X account. Athena Forum is an X also. And we have a website, athena-forum.eu, where you can find our report and all our publications. And I also write a Substack. If you want, you can also have a look there. I share some of my thoughts and reflections there. And thank you to both of you for this invitation and for a very open discussion with you. I really enjoyed the exchange.
I did too. Glad to meet you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have reached the end of the Umbrella Hour. There will be a part two coming up, so make sure you check in. Our guest this hour was Fika El-Nagashi, who is a former member of parliament in Austria with the Greens, a lifelong human rights advocate and founder and director of Athena Forum. Until next time, thank you for listening.